Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to a very special 350th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and it's my great honor to welcome a guest today who is, or at least has been, out of this world. A living legend, a bona fide American hero, and a truly historic figure. He's a graduate of West Point, third in the class of 1951, who served as a fighter jet pilot in the U.S. Air Force during the Korean War, participating in 66 combat missions and destroying two enemy aircraft, and who then returned stateside and earned a Doctor of Science degree from MIT in January 1963, writing his thesis about manned orbital rendezvous, with the hope that it might help him to one day become an astronaut, like his friend Ed White, at the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, which had been established in 1958. And sure enough, just a few months later, in October 1963, he was part of the third group invited to join the space program. His contributions to NASA are numerous and varied, from pioneering underwater training methods to establishing a record for time spent walking in space during a single mission, 5.5 hours, during the November 1966 Gemini 12 mission, the last of the Gemini missions that paved the way for the Apollo missions. But he is, of course, best known as the lunar module pilot on Apollo 11, the first manned space flight to land on the moon, an achievement described by the New York Times as, quote, arguably the most extraordinary feat in human history, close quote, and who on July 20th, 1969, at the age of 39, with an unprecedented audience of some 600 million people watching on TV all around the world, became the second of only 12 men in history, all Americans, to walk on the moon, a mere 20 minutes after the first man, Neil Armstrong. He's a 1969 recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom and now, at the age of 90, an Emmy nominee, along with his sole surviving Apollo 11 colleague Michael Collins, for Best Cinematography for a Nonfiction Program, the excellent CNN documentary Apollo 11. I'm talking, of course, about Dr. Edwin Eugene Aldrin Jr., better known as Buzz Aldrin. But first, I was joined by the director, producer, and film editor of the documentary Apollo 11, who is himself nominated for two Emmys, Best Directing for a Documentary / Nonfiction Program, and Best Picture Editing for Nonfiction Programming, having already won for his work on the film a Peabody Award, the Producers Guild of America Awards' prize for Best Producer of a Documentary Theatrical Motion Picture, the Critics' Choice Documentary Awards' prize for Best Documentary Feature and Best Editing, a special jury award for editing from the Sundance Film Festival, the Best Editing Prize of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, and the American Cinema Editors Awards' Best Edited Documentary Feature Prize, Todd Douglas Miller. Todd, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's great to see you, and congratulations on two Emmy nominations for yourself, and I believe six for this great project that I first had the opportunity to see after we finally kicked Kanye West out of the IMAX screening room, if you remember. That was quite an amazing thing to see this in the ideal format at IMAX headquarters, and instantly became my favorite of the year. And so I'm glad to get to talk to you almost a year later, probably. I don't remember the exact date, but it's been a long journey for you. When did the idea of doing an Apollo 11 documentary first even occur to you?
Well, first off, thanks for having me, and thanks for all you do for the industry. The idea really came out of a short film that we did for Apollo 17, which was the last mission to go to the moon. We had done that as a short film, and it was released through CNN, and we were exposed to a lot of archival materials with just not NASA, but all the Apollo missions, and then also a lot of things that were captured in large format in the late 60s. So that really, and that... It, we knew of some large format. We didn't know, you know, what the final product was going to be, of course. But so we were kind of getting into that. I was working into another project another feature length documentary, and that this one just kind of slowly took over. So we were looking at, you know, just little snippets of some large format, but it was mainly all the 35 and 16 millimeter archival materials. And it just kind of got addictive to work on it. And it kind of slowly took over the course of a couple months several years ago. And then Courtney Sexton with CNN Films called me and said, you know, we want a moon landing film for the 50th anniversary. And that really kind of kicked off everything. So with their backing and kind of the team that we had put together to do the short film, we were really off and running. The stars really aligned, no pun intended, but you know, we had some new scanner technology that we were working with through our post-production facility, Final Frame, that was taking everything from 8mm film all the way up to, you know, IMAX quality film, 70mm, and scanning it in resolutions that hadn't happened before. So we were going all the way up to 16K in some instances. In the middle of that, the National Archives called and said, it was actually an email, I'll never forget it, and said, you know, we have this large format, these reels sitting here, we have no idea what's on them, they say Apollo 11, but, you know, we could get some test reels up there, and once we put the first test reels up, we knew we had, you know, something very special. It's kind of one of those lock the door moments, and just draw on the floor, and that kicked off, you know, a couple years of, you know, working with the material, archiving it, getting it, you know, prepped so I can edit it, put it into the film, working with, you know, the team we put together, and then working with the astronauts and their families to, you know, to try to tell the, you know, a story that had been told a million times, but maybe just kind of focus on the minute details and some of the most exciting aspects of their you know, journey.
Absolutely. Well, before I drill down on some of those points that you raised, I want to just go backwards for a minute. Eastern Michigan University, then film school at the Motion Picture Institute near Detroit. When you came out of that training, entering the world of being a professional filmmaker, was the goal always to make documentaries, or were you thinking in terms of narrative at the beginning?
No, I consider myself a fiction filmmaker. That's the funny thing. So, I am, you know, it's funny. We did the thing last year, and Asif Kapadia and I talk all the time, and you know, Asif and I think we're like-minded in that we don't consider ourselves documentarians. You know, we approach cinema in a very you know, and that it really doesn't matter. You know, these terms are kind of indistinguishable. And I approached Apollo 11 in that way. For me, it was just the cinematographer's role, and my job on set was already done. So it was just, you know, composing it all. But a lot of times you're looking at, you know, different takes, you know, and but you're just using real people as opposed to actors. But to answer your question, when I went to, it was basically a year-long trade school, I really wanted to be a film critic. I wanted to write about film. But then once I got cameras in my hands, I thought that was a little better. it was a lot easier to do document, you know, when I was poor, I was broke, I didn't have any money, and it was just easier to work in the documentary realm. You didn't have to hire. Back then, we were still shooting on film, so you didn't have to hire, you know, a big crew. And it was just a simpler entry point into the production world. But I did do what was basically a short film with three actors at one location. We shot it over a week. That was a fiction film called Scaring the Fish back in, we shot it in 2004, 2005 with Anthony Rapp and Max Casella and Chance Pinnell. So I've never really, you know, thought of myself as a documentary filmmaker. I love it. I'll always do them. But, you know, we're working on, you know, a fiction thing too, and another documentary at the same time. So we kind of, you know, the small team that I work with, we kind of see it as, you know, playing both sides of the fence, I guess.
Sure. And was editing always sort of a specialty of yours? Because I know that one of the things that obviously it's been a focus of the work on Apollo 11, because as you say, you're working with found footage, but it seems like you really have distinguished yourself as a film editor for a while. And I just wonder how that became a particular, you know, skill set of yours.
Yeah, when I was in school, I just I spent a lot of time in, you know, in post rooms. And my first job, I was a lowly PA, you know, taking out the trash at a production company and, you know, cleaning the toilets. And I remember going to some of the post houses back then. And it was really the transition between film and video. Back then, you had the Sony Cine Alta coming out and the Panasonic Vericam. And that was a real eye-opening experience, because I sometimes they would send me, because it was kind of, you know, be late at night. They, all the older, you know, more established people, producers and directors, had families and lives, and I would just sign up for anything. Oh, you want me to run, you know, a quarter-inch tape over to an editor in an online house, you know, in Detroit? Sign me up. I'm there. And I would stay all night and just be a fly on the wall. And I really grew to love editing through that experience, and seeing those rooms change from what took three or four people to run an online room to one person, you know, down to just doing, you know, Final Cut or, you know, an Avid. And I really like the idea of that, just being stuck in a dark room and just kind of creating, you know, the magic of it. And that's really what they were doing. And I wanted to be a part of that. And so that kind of got my foot in the door. I always enjoy being on a set. I always enjoy shooting as well. As you know, I'm very much into the technical aspects of filmmaking. But I find that the most creative space and storytelling is actually in the edit room, when you're there, you know, and you can just be by yourself with the footage. So that's kind of always been my approach, and, you know, in the last, you know, several films, and just bringing in people, because I really enjoy collaboration, and I have, you know, my small team. So just showing them cuts, you know, my music composer, Matt Morton, is very, he's an integral part of what I do, along with sound designer. So, and I trust those guys to give me creative feedback too. So it's almost, I can switch off my, you know, editor hat and directing hat with those guys, and we kind of work, you know, very well together. But it all started just, you know, having seeing other people do the work and seeing how impactful it is in the final product. And that's what really got me into it.
So for any editor, for any filmmaker, to be told that there's a massive amount of footage that's never been really used before from such a historic event as Apollo 11 and everything surrounding it. On the one hand, I'm sure it's exciting. On the other hand, I'm sure it's daunting to now have to piece together 50-year-old stuff that has not been categorized, has not been, you know, in any way synced. I know that was another big challenge for you guys to get. You have a lot of audio, which is great, because I guess each of these people in Mission Control and the astronauts, everybody had their own audio tracks, as I understand it, but nothing synced with each other, let alone with footage. So just as you actually set about piecing this all together, how did you do that? It's such a monumental challenge.
Yeah, I mean, my job was really as kind of a conduit to a really specialized team, and just kind of managing that. So in conjunction with Tom Peterson, my producing partner, who really managed this 10,000 hours plus of audio that we were given, as you mentioned, everyone in Mission Control had a headset. But that, once it, you know, before it got to him, it really came through our archive producer, Steven Slater, and then Ben Feist, who now works for NASA, but at the time was just, you know, a tech guy working at an ad agency. And Ben really did the roll up the sleeves work of cleaning all of that up. And then Steven did the roll up the sleeves job of syncing all of that with all this 16 millimeter footage that was captured inside of Mission Control, and some large format footage. But by the time I got it, and of course, I mentioned Final Frame, the post-production facility, did all of the scanning of all of this material. And then they would give it to me so I could actually work with it, because once it came off the scanner, it was such high quality that I couldn't even use it in an edit suite. So really? I was kind of like not only the conduit, I guess, but kind of the funnel for all of it. And then my job was just time consuming, you know, it was just go through everything. And really working with Tom, we would go through and he would, there was no transcript, so he would really transcode everything and then give me kind of the highlights of, oh, this might be of interest. And many, many things in the film came out of that process. So, for instance, there was a music track that got played during the mission, and Tom found that just literally listening to, you know, the tapes and some of the other, you know, things. So, but it was very useful for me as an editor. I had a transcript. I could go through everything. I could jump to every single, you know, any point in the mission. And, you know, it was almost like a script had already been written. You know, we went to the moon many times. And they did the same types of things every single time. So you kind of knew the highlights of what was going to come. So on Apollo 10, there was kind of, you know, that was really the dress rehearsal. It was like, you know, the rough draft of what Apollo 11 was going to be. So for me, just kind of when I was conceptualizing the film and the structure of it, I knew where all kind of my plot point one was going to happen, plot point two, and, you know, and where act three began. Like, I kind of knew it. So, and because they were so NASA, so, you know, succinct with how they do things and how ordered they are, it followed very closely to laying out a film, mm-hmm. and, you know, and trying to do it in under 2 hours.
Was there one discovery of footage or audio that had never really been used in all these years where you perked up in particular and you're like, you know, I can't believe we've just found this?
Yeah, there was a bunch of them. I'll tell you one. The one that still gets me, because I still get emails about it and I talk to people, and it's really like the really, you know, technical guys will call me about it. But we were in my office. I'd kind of laid out all the photographs that three astronauts had taken once they got into space. And there's over 1,000 images that they captured, which really isn't that much for the Apollo missions. You know, they, for 17, it was, you know, almost 7,000. So, or something astronomical like that. But
yeah,
for Apollo 11, it was over 1,000. So we print them all out, and just trying to understand where the orientation of the spacecraft was important, in that we were trying, you know, we had graphics, you know, that put together to try to give the audience a sense of where you were going to, you know, where you were in space. And it didn't kind of match up that they would take this photograph if the spacecraft was oriented this way, and kind of reading. I mean, we were really getting into the weeds on some of this stuff. But so we challenged Bill Berry, who's the chief historian over at NASA, and some of our other private historians, Robert Perlman, who's down, lives close to JSC down in Houston. And anytime we had kind of a question like that, we'd put the pros at NASA and our independent guys on a parallel path and see what they came up with. And in this case, it was, we had always thought, and this was depicted like in every space film ever made, where the capsule was kind of shot out of a, if you can imagine a bullet shot out of a gun, it was kind of rotating towards the moon. But that didn't make any sense from the photographic evidence we had. So we looked at, I asked Bill Berry if he'd do some research. A month later, he came back. He went into the archives at the MIT Flight Dynamics Group, who developed all the systems, and they found that the command module stack with the LEM, the lunar module on the bottom, actually spun like a top on the way. So they were, it was almost in the film, you hear one of the capsule communicators radio up and say, oh, it's like you guys are in a rotating restaurant. So it was actually spinning like this on its way out to the moon, and then it was pointed celestial south, spinning this way on the way out. And that made all the difference in the world. So suddenly, even though you're in space and, you know, 3D really is, doesn't matter where you are, the orientation, but yeah, it made sense that, you know, shots of the moon and other things that they were seeing were captured in the way that they were. And so that,
that's awesome.
Even though it was, you know, it was important, it was very important to us. I wanted to know, you know, when they slingshot it around the moon, you know, a lot of the photographs that are depicted in previous films just show it like it's, you know, it was, you know, kind of like a, almost a crescent like this, whereas they were coming around, and what the astronauts actually witnessed would have been, you know, how we depicted it in the,
yes,
in the film. And so that, those kind of little discoveries, I always got really excited about. Anytime I got like feedback from Bill and his group at NASA with, you know, exactly what was going on, and wow, we never even knew about this, you know, that was,
yeah,
really exciting for everyone.
That's amazing. Yeah. And I guess if you ever really got stuck with a question, you had the opportunity to and took advantage of the opportunity to pick the brains of two individuals who were actually there, Buzz and Michael Collins. Can you just share, you know, were they made themselves available to kind of provide input or answer questions and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, once we discovered the large format footage, you know, I had no intention of reaching out to them at all. Mainly because our film takes place, I didn't want their 50-year, you know, judgment or 50 years of, you know, revisionist history to be impacted with the way that we wanted to tell the story, which was in the moment. So I didn't think that they could contribute really initially, because I just wanted whatever was in the photographic evidence that we had in the archival to just rule the day and that'd be it. And I was, you know, fingers crossed they'd be happy with the end product and maybe I could connect with them at some point. But once we found the large format footage, in fact, the first phone call I made was to Neil Armstrong's sons, Mark and Rick. I actually went out to Ohio and showed them, you know, the footage, where they live. And, at the time we had just done some tests, and then reached out to Michael Collins and Buzz Aldrin. And, you know, they were just so gracious, all of them and the families. It just wasn't them. It was their daughters, their family members because they went through it all too. And, there was a funny story, Michael Collins. Anytime we had a sequence that, I thought needed to have their eyeballs on it, our good friend Zarth, Barish, that runs the theaters down at, National Air and Space, the IMAX theaters, we would go and test it. So we did some testing, you know, the launch of a Saturn V rocket on Apollo 11. That's a big one I want to get right. So, you know, we had those guys come in, you know, I'm nervous. The whole team, we brought in everybody. We were so nervous. And I remember at the end, saying to Michael Collins, you know, what do you think? You know, is there any, you know, feedback? And he said, you know, well, how the hell should I know? I was on the inside of the capsule, you know. So it was important to have, in that sense, you know, getting like the Armstrong, you know, boys, their feedback, because they witnessed it, you know, as kids and what, and they'd seen, you know, subsequent Apollo 11 rockets and historians as well. And Buzz was invaluable too, Buzz Aldrin, as far as, there's a scene in the film where they notice, eclipse of the moon, solar eclipse, and judging the distance of that, and did we get it right? Is that what it looked like? So it was really important, for him to give his feedback on that. Another one was, the alarms that are going off as they're landing. He's the only one alive that was there that could tell us. And again, usually when it's depicted in a film, you hear it going off in the cabin and this is, you know, really, you know, annoying, you know, thing. And you go, oh my God, there must, you know, are they going to make it? But we actually got the kilohertz tone, that was going through his headset. And he was the one that told us it was in his headset. It wasn't going off in the cabin because that would have, you know, that would have been distracting. That doesn't happen, you know, right. You know, when you're flying a plane. So, just little details like that was, important, and playing that for him. Well, you got too many beeps in there, you know, it was more spaced out. It wasn't that intense. You know, you could scale it back a little. Right. So that was invaluable, getting their feedback.
Amazing. And just for people who are listening, basically, I think that the footage is all essentially almost all organic as you came upon it. But what you're talking about is you guys had to, you enhance the soundscape to make it a full, fully immersive experience where, you know, that if you're just hearing it through somebody's headset, it's not the same as when you guys can kind of amplify it or fine tune it a little bit, right? Yeah. That's where you would.
Yeah, there was no, you know, if people watch the film, there was no sound on anything. We either had to sync it up from original sources, get it from other sources, or, you know, enhance it and try to duplicate exactly what the original sound was. But, you know, 90% of the film is using original sound that's just been cleaned up. And hats off again to Eric Milano, our sound designer, and Brian Eimer, the IMAX mixer. They just did a fantastic job.
So last question is, in addition to yourself as one of the nominees for Apollo 11 at the Emmys, it was caught a lot of people by pleasant surprise to find out that 50 years after the, or 51 years, I guess, after the Apollo 11 mission, Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins are now Emmy nominees for cinematography. And I wonder if you can just set up the next part of this episode by explaining for people who may not know what the source of different footage was, you know, what did Michael and Buzz actually film, and what, you know, what in your view makes them worthy of this recognition all these years later?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't take much research to know that all of the astronauts, particularly the ones on Apollo 11, did a massive amount of training of documenting what they were doing. So it doesn't make any sense if you're just going to go to the moon and not take a camera with you and document it. So when you watch all the training, you know, footage that they went through, they spent an amazing amount of time training with Hasselblad still cameras. They had numerous versions and different ones, not only in the command module, but on the lunar module. They were also running TV, they call it slow scan back then, cameras that did downlink. So all the way on the moon and the moon surface and all the way back, they were, you know, broadcasting TV. So they had to run actual video cameras. And then probably most important, they had these 16 millimeter Westinghouse cameras that ran 16 millimeter film. And again, for anyone that's shot film, you know how difficult it can be. So there's in the audio, they were constantly talking about mission control. You know, what's my inclination of the sun? What, you know, f-stop should I be on? What lens should I have on? And I don't think that you could tell me that there's a better shot in cinematic history than what Buzz Aldrin shot out of window number 2 on the lunar module, landing on another world for the first time. It was just an extraordinary shot. He had to flip on the camera, you know, he mounted it. It's just incredible. And the same could be said for Michael Collins when they fired the engine off the surface of the moon in the lunar module. Michael Collins in the command module, which is orbiting the moon, had to dock with them. And he flipped on a camera and got one of the most amazing shots. We show it completely unedited in the film. It's almost 7 minutes long, and it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous shot. And it's those two shots are my favorite shots in cinematic history. So if, awesome. There's a reason why these guys on Apollo 11 were honorary members of the American Society of Cinematographers. They're ASC members. And I think they should get Oscars for what they did. It's extraordinary. And I'm glad they're getting Emmys and any other cinematography award. I think they rightfully deserve it.
Awesome. Well, Todd, thank you so much for doing this. And congrats again. It's a movie that people should, if they haven't seen it yet, get the biggest screen you can find and watch it on that. And hopefully it'll be back in theaters for future anniversaries. And I know it's in some IMAXs, I think, at museums. And when we can finally leave our homes, just make sure to seek it out, listeners, because it is special. Todd, thank you again.
Thanks so much, Scott.
And now, without further ado, let's go to my conversation with Buzz Aldrin. Dr. Aldrin, it's such an honor to speak with you, and congratulations on your Emmy nomination. Before we get into anything else, though, I just want to ask, how are you holding up during this crazy time in America? I think you have more experience with quarantine than most of us do.
Well, yeah, I had two other guys with me, and somebody who fixed the meals for us. I got somebody who fixes my meals. She's better looking than the one we had in the quarantine trailer.
So you wake up, I guess, on July 28th, and you find out more than 50 years after Apollo 11, suddenly you and Michael Collins are Emmy nominees. Could you wrap your head around that one?
Well, I've expected this all along since 1969, July 28th.
Right.
So I tell you, one of the three of us is really the photographer, and unfortunately, he's not with us to take all the kudos. He kind of left us. I tried to do the best I could with Neil, and Mike was kind of hiding up in orbit, so he could only photograph us until we left or until we got back in again. And of course he had to dust us off from all the lunar dust. when we got back in again, but I'm not taking any credits from him.
Sure, sure.
I don't consider myself the awardee for the space program at this point. We'll stick to Apollo 11.
Yeah. Well, I did understand, though, that the lunar module landing sequence was something that you filmed out the window with a 16 millimeter camera. Is that true?
Well, the 16 millimeter camera was at the right window, and it really didn't take pictures of the touchdown. It was geared to take pictures of Neil after he got down to the surface and was collecting the contingency sample. We had other cameras that were taking pictures of the final approach and the dust and the shadows and the touchdown, but not that 16 millimeter.
Right. Now, for someone who is now an Emmy-nominated cinematographer, I think you did in one interview say that you made one mistake that you kind of regret, and maybe if this is true, it's kind of funny. Did you forget to turn the camera back on after you guys were leaving the moon?
No, we had the camera on as we departed. There wasn't too much to take pictures of.
Mm-hmm.
But the more contested was the camera, or was the landing radar and the rendezvous radar on at the same time that we made powered descent. Now, of course, the checklist said we got to have the landing radar to feed into the computer your altitude and altitude rate. But Dr. Rendezvous from MIT sure didn't want to have anything that might interrupt the rendezvous if we had to abort. So I wanted the data coming from the rendezvous radar and the landing radar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, little did I know that was too much for the computer to handle. And so my lack of awareness turned on some program alarms throughout the descent. But there was one very, very sharp guy in mission control who was able to determine that there was that momentary computer overload. So he said, we're going that flight. And when we got down to even a lower attitude and had a program 1201 instead of 1202, where he said, we're going that one too. So we touched down. And as soon as the probes from the landing gear touch the ground and throw a micro switch, it turns a light on in front of me that says contact light. And so actually the first words from the lunar surface were contact light, engine stop, and a few other words. And a little bit later, Neil got to come up with his classic that I wish I had. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Yes, yes. Now, your first words on the moon were almost, I guess you could say, a little bit of disappointment at the whole thing. I think, you know, I wondered if you know, to call it magnificent desolation, did you find yourself even surprised to be saying those words after such a long trip? Or was it just a bit of a letdown that there wasn't more going on there?
No. Neil described in terms of the upper desert, and he actually used the word magnificent, isn't it? Now, I looked out, and there wasn't a damn thing growing. It was just rolling craters with absolutely no sign of life. So magnificent desolation were the two combinations of words that I felt really covered the extreme, the utter worldly magnificence of two human beings being there. But I don't really think we could have found any spot on Earth more desolate than Tranquility Base was.
Right. So for you, 50 years after that amazing adventure, what was it like to watch footage that they had kind of, I guess, misplaced or just put away for decades? All of this footage from the Apollo 11 mission in the documentary Apollo 11. When you saw Apollo 11, the documentary, what was that like for you?
Well, I think all the people that were able to dust off things and find these films are just to be congratulated. Such a mass of people gathered around. Now, these days, they would have been looking at television much closer to the rocket. I was kind of surprised when I saw the people, I saw the movies of the people on the beach, that the rocket was so far away. You wouldn't get a real good sense of the engine ignition, not as good as you would these days. So I think it was well worth it for all the thousands of people that came out to see that.
Mm-hmm.
It obviously set some kind of a record. We went out there in a trailer from the crew quarters, and when we got to the erector that held the rocket, well, the three of us got out along with the technician, and we went up the elevator, and it stopped before it got all the way to the top. And so I was let off about 30, 40 feet below the walkway that went from the elevator stop to the command module. So I had to wait there until Neil and Mike got put into the spacecraft, because the very disciplined pad leader, Gunter Bent, didn't want all three of us up there at the same time. So I got to stay by myself for about 5 minutes at least, maybe 10, all by myself, standing there next to that rocket, giving off frost fumes from the ice-cold liquid hydrogen and oxygen, and damned if the sun wasn't coming up at just that time. And I'm not saying out loud, but to myself, hey, Buzz, you got to remember this. This is fantastic.
Yes. Leading up to that, you know, just a amazing week in your life, had you ever had second thoughts about staying with NASA? I know you'd done so much work to get there, but then once you were there, there was just, I know there had been tragedy all around you that, you know, as I understand it, that you might not have been a part of the Gemini program if not for one accident. And then the order shuffling that resulted from Apollo 1 is what led to Apollo 11 being possible. So I know you were very close with Ed White, who was one of the people who, you know, was, so like, did at any point, did you have second thoughts about?
Important more than anyone else. He was a year behind me at West Point. We were both on the track team, and he'd gone through the test pilot school. and I had not. However, I got my doctor's degree and studied techniques of bringing two spacecraft together, rendezvous. So I became branded by the jealous Navy test pilots as Dr. Rendezvous. And I was not always in total respect. But yeah, of course. I was actually an Air Force officer in the experiments office in Houston for the NASA program. And I had applied in 1962, the same year that Ed White applied, and he was selected, and I was not. But I kind of felt that, well, sure, being a test pilot's fine, but having some smarts as to know where you're going and what you're going to do, which I thought I got from MIT.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so. I began lobbying in a way, letting the people down in Houston know just how clever I was, and whether that worked or not. At least I got a call in mid-October from Dick Slayton, and the next month, JFK was assassinated in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of put a different motivation or slant on the program. But because of Ed White's involvement in Gemini 4, I went down there for that launch. And of course, I had known he and his wife, Pat. We were in the same squadron in Germany, and we represented our squadron in NATO gunnery competition over in Europe. So we really got very close. We were on the track team, went down to Madison Square Garden to compete for West Point. Ed was in the high hurdles, and I was a pole vaulter.
Ah.
So I jumped a little higher than he did.
So, you know, everyone asks you, understandably, about Apollo 11, but I want to ask you about Gemini 12, because, you know, you in that mission established the record for time spent walking in space. I know 5.5 hours. And I wanted to ask you, as a guy who writes for a Hollywood publication, do you feel that any movie has really captured what spacewalking is actually like? I think about Gravity and so many that have tried to depict it, but have you seen it done well ever?
Well, we'd have trouble with some of the crew members not being able to maintain a good position when they were outside the spacecraft, and that included Gemini 10 and 11. So some engineers from Baltimore had been experimenting in a swimming pool at, I forget the name of the boys' school, with underwater weighted down with weights around your legs and arms to establish a neutral buoyancy. And that sounded very appropriate and clever to me. I do remember that there are a couple of other skeptical astronauts who said, well, how can you possibly simulate a vacuum up in space and the gravity up there by doing something underwater with all the viscosity and still all the pressure that you've got and still the gravity? But being a scuba diver for 9 years, I certainly recommended or recognized the great merit in doing that. So we instituted neutral buoyancy for the beginning of the training of Gemini 9, and that didn't go too well. No, I don't think we had neutral buoyancy, but I know that the pilot on Gemini 9 just got way overheated.
Mm-hmm.
Later became my backup for the EVA on Gemini 12, which was split into three different EVAs, and it was all that I expected. It was quite creative, and would enable only one foot in the restraint and to lean back and to move around with great control. And so that was the pioneering of neutral buoyancy. And for every spacewalker EVA since then, we've always concentrated on neutral buoyancy.
Yes.
So
yes.
I felt for being an underwater aficionado and scuba diver that was quite a good contribution to the business of spaceflight, in addition to the method of bringing a spacecraft to a proper position approaching another one.
Absolutely.
And that had worked so well in the Gemini program that there was an engineer who kind of took up the cause of concentric orbit rendezvous for the moon. And looking backwards, there were two individuals who contributed to the success of Apollo in the maneuvering. The first was John Humboldt, a Langley Research Center, a very smart engineer, who proposed lunar orbit rendezvous, where before going down to the surface and coming back, there would be a rendezvous in lunar orbit. Now, the rendezvous itself, or bringing together the spacecraft, was the contribution that I made.
Yes.
So I like to feel that John and I really contributed very significantly to the basic success of the steps leading to a landing.
Absolutely. And I've always wondered, ahead of the Apollo 11 mission, did you, Neil and Michael Collins, ever discuss, were you ever kind of candid with each other about what you thought the chances were of a successful lunar landing and of successfully returning to Earth? Did you kind of talk in terms of percentages or anything like that?
See, the number comes into mind. I can't say that we would go back and verify that, but I think maybe 60%. Right now, I'm investigating in general terms what would happen if the circuit breaker that had broken off, the engine arm circuit breaker that had broken off, and that I later used a felt tip pen at the right time to push the region of the circuit breaker in, and it engaged. Now, suppose it had not. Well, could we have tried again 2 hours later when Mike Collins comes around again, and maybe a day later, we're going to run out of oxygen and electrical power. So if you can't get electrical power to the engine, you're staying on the moon. You're not coming back home.
Oh, my God.
Now, what happens? Well, presumably, the backup crew the system would rush another rocket and get the backup crew within a couple of months up there, and they would be able to bring back some rocks and a couple of pieces of evidence, like a broken circuit breaker and a pen.
Right.
Now, those two items are symbolically very significantly associated with the trials and tribulations. That's probably not the best word, since much more serious than that, but we lost three crewmen on Apollo 1, mm-hmm. and managed to overcome that tragedy. And of course, space is not a trouble-free environment. And I thought, well, if somebody's going to perish on the moon, why not Neil and I?
And it was also, wasn't it also a close call with just landing when you were landing on the moon? I don't know if it's apocryphal, but I always have read that you guys were literally within 30 seconds of running out of fuel. So what would have happened then?
There's a button that says abort, in which case the descent and ascent engines light, and you lift off and maintain thrust. Now, there's another button that's also kind of separated it so you won't mistake, and it's called abort stage. So it discards the descent stage, lights the ascent stage, and now you depart from wherever you are and intercept the ascent computer program. Now, just how low you can still do that, I think, is a question of timing of electrical signals getting to some place to do something. And you just got to rely on somebody having done that calculation. But of course, we have an idea, because Charlie Duke, back on Earth, Mission Control, calls out 60 seconds and then 30 seconds, and we're still about 10 feet above the ground, 5 feet maybe. So we touch down, and this serviceman with the dipstick comes out and checks the amount of fuel in the tanks.
Yes, yes. Interesting. Well, you know, I know that you're a hero to a lot of people for two reasons. One, obviously, the work that you've done in space, but also, two, for how candid you were at a time when not a lot of people were about your struggles with depression and alcoholism and everything when you came back. And I wonder what you believe to be the case. Do you believe that that was primarily genetic, since you've acknowledged that, you know, a number of members of your family, including your grandfather and your mother, had taken their own lives even before the time you went to Apollo 11? Or do you think that it was brought on, as a lot of people like to speculate, because, you know, seeing the Earth from the moon or from space makes us feel so, you know, would make you feel smaller or insignificant or anything like that? Or do you think that's just pop psychology?
I forget what they call it, the outer space phenomena. I forget, there was a very wise person who came up with a name for it. But no, I don't really think there was that. See, before I get into that, let me say a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
We keep hearing about policemen and their body cameras. Neil had a body camera that was mounted to the front of his spacesuit so that he could use his hands doing things and still with minimum activity see what the cameras pointed at. So he was in a position where I was moving around and he occasionally would be stationary and could take my picture. So, of course, the most famous one was taken very suddenly. He said, "Hey, hold it." And I turned and looked at him, and he took that visor picture where the reflections of the spacecraft and his reflection and the shadows. Now, I got my chance when I had the camera, and I was just fascinated with the boot imprints. And, of course, there was a whole bunch of them around something that we were doing. So I picked a smooth spot and put my foot down and then took a picture of that. And I thought, gee, that's kind of lonesome. So put my foot down, then moved the boot just a little bit so you could see the boot that was that had made the boot print. So I guess there are kind of two distinctly different photographs that that characterize Apollo 11. One of them is a boot print, and the other is the very beautiful picture that Neil took of me.
Yes.
that has all the reflections in it and is used very famously.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there is some kind of a frustration in not knowing exactly what to do and feeling confident about moving in that direction, a degree of loneliness and irritation. And once you start down the path of trying to get sober, you find that that's not as easy as you thought.
Mm-hmm.
But you get other guys around you to help you. And then you begin to accumulate days of sobriety, and that becomes like an investment. And I've got 41, 42 years invested now.
Amazing.
In sobriety.
Congratulations. And,
really, I don't miss anything that is a craving. I recognize what it does. And it's not what I need to become a part of my performances anymore. I'm as proud of that as I'm more proud of that than I am how many dollars I've got in my invested accounts.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's all right with you, I would like to maybe zoom through several just quick things, and then I'll leave you alone. But I guess, first of all, what's the one question you'd like never to be asked again?
What did it feel like?
Everyone feels the need to tell you where they were when you were on the moon. What's the weirdest story that you've heard?
Well, I like to get their reaction when I say, well, I know where I was.
What is the best movie about space?
Apollo 11.
Good answer. What do you miss most and least about being in space? You accumulated so many hours there. I wonder, as you think back, what do you miss and what do you definitely not miss?
Well, I certainly can't complain about the liftoff. That's, of course, the most hazardous part, considering an engine failure and loss of control.
Mm-hmm.
Having a mission that has a major significant contribution to advancing space capabilities. And that's why, oh, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I began to think of a lunar cycler that would go around the Earth, go around the moon, and come back and go around the Earth and around the moon and just keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out that the orbits of flyby are not ideal. So I think the Chinese, in chasing that, are probably a little in error. Now, that cycler gave way to a Mars cycler, and that one works also, but there are several ways of implementing that, and some are a little bit more made difficult by the eccentricity of Mars orbit.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think that there are ways of fine-tuning the thrust available to make up for that. In the meantime, I am very impressed with Elon Musk's SpaceX
mm-hmm.
Starship refueling capabilities for going to the moon and going to Mars. He is using methane, which is available at Earth for launch and refueling. And if it's taken to the moon, you can't get the carbon on the moon
mm-hmm.
and the helium and the oxygen. But at Mars, there's carbon dioxide and there's water. So it's a good choice. And I think Jeff Bezos has the same choice, but I think Elon Musk with his Starship is way ahead of Bezos right now. And unfortunately, 15 years ago, or maybe something like that, we got locked into what became Ares 5 and then the Space Launch System, or SLS, and it is continually over budget, over schedule,
mm-hmm.
and it is expendable. So it is just a poor investment for a nation that wants to compete with the commercial launches of Bezos and Elon Musk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're reusable, fly again capabilities, and couple those with some of the landers and other things. And I don't become too popular when I have joined many others in suggesting that Boeing's rocket is just not appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't think I could be a bigger admirer of yours until I saw the video on YouTube of that jerk who was harassing you and kind of implying that you guys had faked the landing and you fought back. And I just wonder, how much of that sort of thing do you encounter and how do you explain it? What is wrong with people?
Well, I had seen the guy once before, and I guess there are a number of wannabes, maybe. When I spotted en route to the moon a light opposite us moving along in about the same direction, we looked at it through the telescope and then the sextant, and I happened to know or remember that when I was in flight dynamics, I just wandered around and saw this chart that portrayed the trajectory that four panels that enclosed the lander, and when the command module separated those four panels, went in four different directions, uncontrolled.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going along right with us. And if you look out a window at the right time, you're just liable to see something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, they become UFOs and and not too distant. Phenomena astronautical unidentified.
So you don't believe in aliens or do you? I mean, I guess what is an alien? I guess it could be any form of life anywhere else in the. Do you think there is anything else out there?
Well, I can say it's anybody's guess, but that includes an awful lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
when you get into artificial intelligence and automation that can sense what's going on all around and has such high degrees of performance, I don't say it's highly probable, but of all the opportunities that exist in the billions and billions and billions of opportunities, somebody's liable to be head and shoulders above everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we are. I don't know how we ever know that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to be around when we really see evidence of one.
Yes.
Hell, I've seen us land once on the moon. I'm waiting for twice. And then this damn COVID-19 came along and screwed us up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been not helpful. So you said, quote, "My proudest moment was when I saluted the American flag on the surface of the moon," close quote. Do you think that that flag that you guys planted there is still standing?
No, I'm quite sure that even some, I forget the name, Lunar Orbiter 10 or something has taken very accurate pictures of the landing sites. So accurate that you can see the dust kicked up by Neil when he went from the spacecraft back behind us to take a look at the crater. And then when he came back, it was a different pathway. And you can see the sprinkling of the lunar dust. It couldn't have been done by anything other than that. Now, that certainly is a piece of evidence. And I think Hess and others would indicate that the solar radiation would have had a very destructive effect on any cloth.
Mm-hmm. And were you able to bring back anything from, or, you know, retain anything from the mission? Did you keep your uniform or rock, you know, or dust or anything from the mission?
Well, as I said, that alternate mission, when there wasn't a problem and we came home as planned, the broken circuit breaker and the felt tip pen are probably the most meaningful. I have a little ring on my little finger that was my grandfather's Masonic ring. I almost didn't take it, but I discovered it at the last couple of seconds and got it on my finger before we went out to the spacecraft. I think there are a few other things. I'm very concerned that of the valuable, meaningful Omega watches that Neil did not wear his out on the surface, but left it inside for some reason that didn't make sense to me at the time. But I wore mine outside. And when we came back, before I moved from Houston to Edwards Air Force Base, I wanted to send a couple of, or a bunch of high value things to the Smithsonian, and that pen and circuit breaker and watch were among those things. And they were last seen laid out on a desk at NASA in Houston, and the watch never arrived.
Oh, no. So somebody has those. That's terrible. Well, I guess I just want to finally ask you, because, you know, it's now been 51 years. You've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly that has come with, you know, the trip to the moon. I know that you've said that obviously there were those hard times that came afterwards. I'm sure that fame is not always the most fun thing. But if you could go back in time and decide whether or not to do it again, would you have preferred to live a more kind of conventional, normal life, or are you happy with the decisions that you made?
Oh, absolutely. Tickled pink to have been in a position to be able to take advantage of the things that kind of opened up for me. A lot of factors fed into that. Some of it was my family. My father's a pioneering aviation, just kind of set the stage. And then he introduced me to Jimmy Doolittle and some other people. And they just kind of evolved to inspire me to not just be an ordinary person, but to seek out how I could take what I had to offer and make it meaningful. And over the years, I've found a few things. I love to make sketches of orbits, but I don't like to put a lot of words in paragraphs and other things. If somebody writes something down, I'll tell them what's wrong. But originality of literary and artistic, other than just representative, and that's been good enough.
Yeah, yeah.
To get the ideas across. Of course, you get a little irritated when somebody doesn't understand what you're talking about.
I bet.
Let me give you one other shocking number.
Please, yes.
Most of us in the space program were military. Mm-hmm. Navy, Marine, Air Force. And we received our normal with rank monthly compensation plus flying time. Mm-hmm. Of course, that was called hazardous. But that didn't mean it was hazardous. It just meant it was flying time, 4 hours a month, going up a little bit more. And if you travel somewhere, you get your travel expenses paid. So being in the Air Force and active duty, as most of the rest of them were, we went on a travel expedition that involved a van to go from the quarters out to the rocket, an elevator, and then a rocket to go all the way to the moon, and then some wheels and walking and other stuff, and then a rocket to come back, and the Navy picked this up, and then we flew in a Air Force airplane back home.
Mm-hmm.
So that completed our travel. So when I filed that travel voucher claim, it also included a rental car from the airport in Florida to the crew quarters.
Mm-hmm.
So I got reimbursed $31.33 for going to the moon and back.
Oh, my God.
Somehow I had to earn the rest of it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad they didn't ask you. I assume they didn't ask you for your passport when you got back, right?
No, we had to clear customs.
Did you really?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, my God.
we brought some mineral rocks and hopefully no germs, because we were in quarantine for 21 days after we came back.
Right, right. Well, I bet you never thought you'd wind up in quarantine again, but here we are. And
Well, I've had a number of things, like the end of World War I, my father flew the Hindenburg over to Germany, and then it burned out on the way back. As a teenager during World War II, and Hiroshima fought in the Korean War. Skipped Vietnam because of space, and then stumbled the rest of my way, getting all the help I could. And writing books and spreading myself around and, I guess, helping people.
Absolutely.
Somehow I missed that milestone in life called retirement and vacation.
No golf for you, right?
No golf. No golf.
Well, I hope you enjoy yourself however you see fit. And we're just so lucky to have you. And I thank you so much for your service and for doing this. It's just a real honor to get to speak with you. And I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you.
Thanks very much for tuning into Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free and leave us a rating on iTunes or your podcast app, as well as on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/awardschatter. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/the race. Until next time, thanks for joining us.